It is Friday, April 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump faced yet another chaotic week. Houston, Texas bids farewell to former First Lady Barbara Bush.
She was just an example of living a full life.
And a new exhibit begins in a Midwestern city that has a connection to Holocaust victim Anne Frank. It's all ahead. To some, it may seem just like another week at the Trump White House. Word of a potentially historic breakthrough on North Korea is forced to compete with a scathing assessment of the president by his former FBI director and court appearances by his personal lawyer and an adult film actress who claims she had an affair with the president. Some in Washington ask, is this the new normal, or is it simply the political phenomenon of Donald Trump breaking the mold once again? VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
It will be a great day for them. It will be a great day for the world.
President Trump at his Florida resort, raising hopes for a breakthrough on North Korea and containment of its nuclear threat. But within minutes, Trump shifted to blast the Russia probe that continues to cast a shadow over his administration.
It is a bad thing for our country, very, very bad thing for our country. But there has been no collusion. They won't find any collusion. It doesn't exist.
The president remains engaged in a war of words with James Comey, the man whose firing as FBI director set in motion the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller to lead the Russia investigation. Comey told USA Today he worries the president may fire Mueller and the man he reports to, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein.
That is a fundamental attack on the rule of law. So that's the most important thing. All of us should care about that. Again, this is above politics, above party affiliation, because it's all we are as a country.
Trump was asked about the fate of Mueller and Rosenstein at his news conference.
They've been saying, I'm going to get rid of them for the last 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, and they're still here. So we want to get the investigation over with, done with, put it behind us.
But some of the president's friends and outside advisors are urging him to take action, says journalist Jonathan LaMare.
A number of those people have suggested to him, like, hey, you need to be tougher. Mueller is imperiling your presidency. You should fire him.
The Russia probe and the recent FBI raids targeting Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, continue to bring great political uncertainty for the White House, says American University analyst Chris Edelson.
We're coming to some kind of a head. I mean, certainly this Cohen news is a really big deal, and maybe we'll find out more about that in the not-too-distant future. But it's hard to say with certainty what that means. Does that mean weeks or months? I don't know for sure.
Cohen appeared in federal court earlier in the week, along with adult film star Stormy Daniels, sparking a media frenzy in Manhattan. The president has denied Daniels' claim that they had an affair and any knowledge of a payoff to allegedly silence her arranged by Cohen. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's going on?
I sort of feel like I have a little bit of whiplash from that story and the news of this week. Well, and it might be a little bit of that in the social media segment today. So, of course, today is April 20th, 420. Now, that marks a number of things. On a sad note, this is the 19th anniversary of the school shooting at Columbine High School just south of Denver. 19 years ago, more than, you know, several dozen students and teachers lost their lives along with the two student shooters. Today, a lot of students around the country are organizing what they call a national school walkout to mark this and then also to sort of kind of keep pressure and keep attention on this topic of school shootings. A lot of people talking about it with this hashtag national school walkout. For example, David Hogg, who of course was one of the student leaders that emerged from the most recent shooting down in Florida. Why should we be expected to work in school when our elected officials won't work to ensure safety and security of our citizens, children, and futures. Not everybody is so thrilled with the idea of the student walkout, however. Here's Patriot Girl 26. The U.S. ranks 17th in the world for education. Students stage walkouts. Teachers indoctrinate students with their political opinions. Professors spew hate for our military and president. Maybe if more time was spent teaching subjects, we could get back into the top 10. Mark Pantano has this: 40,000 Americans killed each year by motor vehicles. I can assume that these snowflakes, as he refers to those in the walkout, will be walking out of school to demand that we ban cars as well. So again, lots and lots of people are voicing their opinions about this, you know, these whether it's appropriate for students to be walking out in protest of these school shootings and in protest of government inaction, they would say. That's on that side. On the other side, of course, 420 today is a day that is sort of, in the United States and a number of countries around the world, kind of considered a marijuana day. It's the whole 420 thing. I'm not going to get into the whole thing of how it got started, but 420, it has become shorthand for, you know, everybody light up. So here's Jimmy Palmiotti. Happy 420 day, everybody. In every state where it's legal, to those other states, get with the program already. My opinion is if you have alcohol in your state already, then this is a no-brainer. Let's see. Happy 420, says Virginia Purcell. Please remember that countless people are currently incarcerated because of marijuana offenses. So lots of people talking about that as well. Just a busy day out there.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Russian sources indicate President Vladimir Putin is ready to meet with President Donald Trump. Wells Fargo agrees to pay $1 billion to settle customer abuse charges. A roadside bomb kills 5 civilians in Afghanistan. And as we heard, U.S. students mark the nationwide walkout day. Expanded coverage of these and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The World Health Organization considers cardiovascular disease to be the number one killer in the world, and among the top risk factors for heart disease is obesity. A recent study led by researchers from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Maryland suggests that losing weight may not be as important as the number of years a person was overweight or obese regarding their risk of heart disease. The researchers say the number of years someone spends overweight or obese can combine to form a distinctive risk factor for so-called silent heart damage. The study suggests that sustaining a healthy weight across one's life is important for keeping the heart healthy and reducing damage as people get older. The researchers point out that their study was only designed to illuminate possible relationships between long-term obesity and heart disease. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an exhibit honors Anne Frank opens in Iowa. Today in Houston, Texas, the public is paying respect to former First Lady of the United States, Barbara Bush. At St. Martin's Episcopal Church, Mrs. Bush's coffin is lying in repose from noon until midnight. Her invitation-only funeral will take place Saturday, with current First Lady Melania Trump and former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton attending. Mrs. Bush died Tuesday at the age of 92. Anita McBride is currently executive in residence at the School of Public Affairs at American University, directing programs on the legacies of America's First Ladies. She was director of White House personnel under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. She was also chief of staff to former First Lady Laura Bush. Ms. McBride spoke with me about what the death of Barbara Bush means to the Bush family.
I think it has a tremendous impact on the family, and it also has a tremendous impact on the country for primarily the same reason. She was just an example of living a full life and a wonderful life and using every opportunity she had in front of her to be engaged to the fullest and to make a difference. And the fact that she was honest and forthright and, you know, was able to really navigate difficulties of politics with humor. I mean, that was an example to her family, just the abiding love she had for them, in addition to the example that she set for them for a public life. And I think Americans responded to that. They responded to the genuineness. They responded to someone who was comfortable in her own skin and would be honest.
She was the wife and mother of presidents, the only person except for Abigail Adams to be in that situation in U.S. history.
Right.
She was, however, you know, very down to earth, and she very much promoted literacy. Why did she concentrate on that as her project?
Well, two things. One, to your first point about being her unique, you know, role in history, along with Abigail Adams, of being the mother of a president, wife of a president. What was so different about these two, though, is that Barbara Bush lived through her and walked the journey of her son's presidency, where Abigail Adams did not. So it really is an especially unique position. And in the Bush's lifetime, the two of them together were very philanthropic. And really, now by the end of her life, they've raised over $1 billion for causes and charities that were really important to them. Cancer research, because, of course, they lost a daughter to leukemia who was 3 years old. Literacy, because they had, you know, a son who was dyslexic and had difficulty reading. And Barbara Bush charged full in into the cause of literacy. And, you know, really believing that if more people could read, write, and comprehend, that they would be that much closer to solving so many problems that plague our society. And so that became her primary cause, but boy, she was really involved with many more.
I believe you worked with her at the White House. What was she like to work with?
Well, you know, they were really together. The two of them were a wonderful partnership as president and first lady. She was focused on, you know, issues of educational literacy that she cared about, and she had a team that she gave direction to that was very clear from the day she had her platform as first lady. She said, I want to do something every day that helps somebody. And that's a simple statement, but it has a profound impact when you are committed to that. And people around the White House, all of us on the staff, we knew that. We knew that she was sincere and dedicated and devoted, and also, you know, engaged in things that help to move our country forward. For an example, you know, in the 80s, there was still this stigma attached to the issue of HIV/AIDS, and that people really believed you could catch AIDS by simply being in close proximity to someone who had it. And what she did to begin to, you know, send a message without even saying a word, but she went to a hospice here in Washington that was for babies with AIDS, you know, and held and hugged babies who were dying of AIDS. And it sent a message without saying, you know, a word about addressing the stigma, which she was saying, these children need our love and compassion, and we don't need to be afraid. And I think we were proud of her and the White House staff for seeing her do something like that.
This must be so hard on her husband. They were married more than 70 years, and,
73.
You know, 73 years. And have you heard how he's doing?
Yes, I have. And in fact, you know, he himself, I mean, true to form, and this is one thing that I think I so respected about the Bushes, too, they always thought about the other guy. And so he put out a message that he said, I knew my beloved wife was loved. But the outpouring, you know, of messages from around the country and the tributes and from around the world just really underscored just how deeply people felt about her and how special she was. And he said, I want to tell we miss her, but I want everybody to know, take the Bushes off your worry list. We are going to be fine. And, you know, I mean, it's just really an amazing example, very selfless. And that was, for any of us working on the staff and were able to work so closely with them, that is something we saw every single day.
Anita McBride, the director of White House personnel under President George H.W. Bush. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A permanent exhibit opened this week in the Midwestern city of Danville, Iowa, that tells a story about famed Holocaust victim Anne Frank. Two sisters in the town exchanged letters with Frank and her sister Margot, who were in Amsterdam just as Nazi Germany invaded the Netherlands. The Frank sisters' father, Otto, spoke English and translated for his daughters. Janet Hessler is an historian with the Danville Historical Society. She tells me about the unlikely correspondence between Anne Frank and an Iowa girl in 1940.
Well, in 1939, we had a very innovative teacher here by the name of Miss Bertie Matthews. She traveled extensively and studied in New York in the summers, I think just to bring knowledge home to rural Danville kids. In 1939, she started what she called her International Correspondence Exchange Program. And the 6th through 8th grade students wrote across the world, would send a portfolio to try to find other students to correspond with. And in January of 1940, names arrived from a Montessori school in Amsterdam, and the little girl Juanita Wagner from Danville picked out the name of Anne Frank. You know, I don't know what she initially wrote, although we think she probably said how she lived on a farm and had an older sister, and her father had been deceased for many years before that, so her mom taught at a country school in Danville. And we know that she wrote that she lived close to Burlington and to find Burlington on the map, because when Anne wrote back, she did just that. She said that she had found Burlington on the map. Anne wrote back and said that she was interested in corresponding with Juanita again. She sent a school picture. She talked about, in fact, she sent a postcard and talked how she collected picture postcards, and at that time she had 800 of them. And because Juanita evidently had said she had an older sister, Anne's older sister, Margot, wrote to Juanita's older sister, Betty, so and enclosed it in that same letter. The letters were written on April 29, 1940, and Betty's letter, you know, showed just a lot more, probably, age, maturity. She, and I'll read it here, she wrote, "I only have two cousins, boys, living at Basel, Switzerland. For American ideas, this is not far, but for us, it is. We have to travel through Germany, which we cannot do, or through Belgium and France, and in that we cannot either. It is war, and no visas are given." So she was much more aware, you know, of the surroundings and of things happening. And if you remember in history, the Nazis invaded the Netherlands on May 10th, 1940. So we only have one letter from each of them.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the two sisters and the correspondence between, you know, among those sisters.
Right.
So how is this new museum, I believe it's called the Anne Frank Connection, how is that going to honor the correspondence and the life of Anne Frank?
Well, one thing I think that we do that's really neat, for the last 5 years, our eighth graders also have taken up on doing an international correspondence exchange. In social studies, they learn a little bit about the Holocaust, and then they send out packets across the world to try to obtain 1.5 million postcards to represent the number of children that were killed during the Holocaust. So postcards because Anne collected postcards, and then because, you know, Anne was a child herself when she was killed. So trying to collect $1.5 million to represent the children's lives that were lost.
Have you been in, you probably have been in contact with the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam?
Yes. Yes, we have. Throughout our museum, we have a lot of quotes of Anne. And, of course, we've had to get permissions for every quote that we have on display. So, yes, I have been in contact with them.
And I just also wanted to check, apparently the original letters, I believe, is it the Simon Wiesenthal?
Yes.
They have that in Los Angeles.
Yes. Betty and Juanita moved a lot of times after they left Danville, and they ended up in California. And when the play came out, Betty realized, wow, you know, I have something from this Anne Frank that has this play, The Diary of Anne Frank. So at one point in time, they were out with a friend, a Jewish friend, for supper, and he was collecting World War II memorabilia, and he was talking about it to them, and Betty just said, you know, I have something you might be interested in seeing. So she took him back home, and the letters were in a book, and so she opened the book and got the letters out to show him. And, you know, he was just astounded that she had something like that. So he suggested hiring an auction house to sell them at auction. And they did. They sold for $165,000 at auction and were given then to the Simon Wiesenthal Center. So we have copyright and, you know, copies of the copy. We are trying to obtain a pre-World War II rail car to put in our back parking lot to house all of the postcards in. There's three rail cars left in Macedonia, and we have got somebody that's over there trying to place bids on them so we can bring a rail car to Danville, and that's where we will store the 1.5 million postcards.
Janet Hessler, an historian with the Danville Historical Society. Anne Frank's The Diary of a Young Girl has been translated into more than 60 languages. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Pastor Andrew Brunson went on trial in Turkey this month for alleged ties to terrorism and espionage. He is a Presbyterian minister who lived in Turkey for more than 20 years and served a small church in the southwestern city of Izmir. He has been detained for the past 18 months. The Turkish government alleges that Pastor Brunson has ties to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, a terrorist group. It also alleges he has ties to the network of a U.S.-based Muslim cleric, Fethullah Gulen, who the Turks accuse of launching a coup attempt in 2016. On the first day of his trial, Brunson denied the alleged ties to Kurdish terrorists or Gulen's network. "I don't accept any of the allegations or accusations," he told the court. He went on to say, "I haven't done anything against Turkey. On the contrary, I love Turkey. I have been praying for Turkey for 25 years." In a statement, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, "We have seen no credible evidence that Mr. Brunson is guilty of a crime and are convinced that he is innocent. We believe that Turkey is a state bound by the rule of law, and we have faith in the Turkish people's commitment to justice. We hope that the judicial system in Turkey will resolve his case in a timely, fair, and transparent manner." Sam Brownback, United States Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, attended Pastor Brunson's trial. He stressed that the Trump administration is deeply concerned about this case. He added, "We completely believe factually he is innocent. We are hopeful that the judicial system will find that he will be released soon."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. Thank you.